Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome back Lydia Yuknovich, author of the new memoir, Reading the Waves, from Riverhead Books. Lydia is the nationally best-selling author of the novels Thrust, The Book of Joan, Dora, A Headcase, and The Small Backs of Children, which won the 2016 Oregon Book Award's Ken Kesey Award for Fiction, as well as the OBA Reader's Choice Award. Her work includes the nonfiction book The Misfits Manifesto and the memoir The Chronology of Water, which was just adapted for the big screen by Kristen Stewart. In addition to the two Oregon Book Awards, Lydia was a finalist for the Brooklyn Public Library Literary Prize and the Penn Center USA Creative Nonfiction Award. Her TED Talk, The Beauty of Being a Misfit, currently has over 4 million views. Lydia founded the workshop series Corporeal Writing here in Portland, where she teaches both in person and online. The San Francisco Chronicle calls Reading the Waves a mighty mishmash of a memoir. Joy, sorrow, rage, fear, guilt, lust, adoration, it's all there in equal parts. The book empowers us to consider, when we look back at our past, how comfortable are we with seeing who we really were and embracing that version of ourself, however flawed? Perhaps more importantly, how do we shed the parts of us we no longer find useful to become something new? Please join us for our conversation with Lydia, which is already in progress. Well, Lydia, welcome back to KBOO. I really am so happy to be talking with you today in person.
My complete pleasure. I love talking to you too, and you know it.
Oh, thank you. Well, when we talked in January 2020, BC, and we were talking about COVID before we sat down before the mic, it was for a short story roundtable with three other great Portland-based writers, Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, and Margaret Malone. We were discussing the short story in the novel, and you said, "I write in literary fragments, period, and sometimes those fragments find a place to resolve or a place to hold attention open, and those are short stories. And sometimes those fragments go on in my work, and they turn into novels." Is that true for memoirs like Reading the Waves?
That's a great question. I think with Reading the Waves in particular, an unusual thing happened to me in terms of form, which is I became mesmerized by, or maybe haunted by, or just, you know, really pulled, I think it's fair to say, by a different formal concept, which is return and repetition and a kind of circle or spiral pattern. Which is different than what to do with fragments. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. You talk about repetition quite well. In fact, there's certain lines and words that are repeated throughout.
Many. And so it's as if, I mean, if we were talking about fragments as a form, this has a very different form in terms of keeping something in motion and keeping a return or some waves happening. But that's not to say that the fragments are gone. I think the fragment takes shape in Reading the Waves, kind of like sand at the beach. I think sediments of shells and sand and stuff from my whole life kind of resolve and dissolve in this storytelling. And that's how it seems a little bit different.
Is it kind of like a motif in music, like a Wagnerian opera or something?
Yeah, maybe not Wagner.
Okay, not Wagner. Yeah, a little rough, but kind of hinting at the theme or playing, teasing the theme now and then.
Very much. There are words in musicology that fit what I just described for sure. Yeah.
Well, your writing's a lot like music.
It's
lyrical and poetic.
And that you notice that makes me feel kindred with you. I don't know if everybody noticed.
I don't see how anybody can miss it. It's just beautiful
lovely.
To read. In fact, I've got several quotes here. And when I was going over them, I was saying, man, I really love reading this.
You know?
How it's fun. Just,
it just works really well. And the funny thing was, you narrated the latest version of the audiobook for Reading the Waves.
Yeah.
And I just listened to that. And you did such a great job. It was, I don't know if it works so well for fiction, but for a memoir, when the author reads it in your voice and so well, it just took on new meaning. I had already read it twice in print.
Yeah. That's interesting. I recorded that. You know, I never got the chance to record Chronology of Water in my own voice, but right when I was recording Reading the Waves, I got an offer to record Chronology of Water too. So I did them both in the same couple of months.
Is that out now then?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I just want to say out loud, it was a trip to read that older memoir and this newer thing with each other.
Side by side.
Yeah, that was a trip. I was like, holy shit. First of all, I'm old. And secondly, you know, what a strange relationship.
Right.
Dance they made together.
Yeah, it's funny because when I first read it in print, we were supposed to talk back in March around pub date.
Yeah.
And we rescheduled. We can get into that later.
Yeah.
I was reading the Waves in print, and I was listening to the original audiobook of Chronology of Water before your version came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was amazing how they kind of played off each other. Definitely a difference in the person writing it, but talking about a lot of the same events, just from a different perspective, it seems.
Yeah, and that the way that time allows for, you know, things to come apart and re-resolve differently. And, you know, you have perspective differently. And you, when you turn and look at something, it's a different perspective than happening this moment. And with Chronology of Water, for me, there was this urgent need to invent a language to account for what I was feeling. And the impulse of Reading the Waves wasn't like that at all. It was an older woman's stepping back, an older person's, you know, calmly turning her head more than one direction. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, but I think that kind of almost limits what you do in the book, the older woman looking back.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe it's not inventing a new language because you've done that, but I think your writing gets better and better. I mean, we talk
you
for...
You are so kind.
We talked for Thrust, and that was, one of the best books I've read in years.
You were my favorite person on the planet when you told me that. It made me so happy because that book was really personally important to me. But, you know, readers do what they want with the art you make. But that book was a big deal for me to write.
Well, I know people who it affected quite a bit too.
Thank you.
And of course, that's fiction. It's a novel. But there's a little bit of Liddy in there.
Oh, God, yes.
Which we could talk about. But you're talking about the old woman part. You're younger than me. So you.
I hear you.
Yeah. You just turned 62 last month, and you write in the book's preface, "I am aging. I am turning around looking back in an effort to gather and give over what I found. At 60, I wonder differently than I did when I was younger. How I wonder has shifted, as well as what I wonder about." Any reader of the book will know that wondering comes very naturally to you. And you mentioned the word kind of this repetitive numerous times in the text. What changed wondering before and wondering now as you reach, as you pass 60?
Yeah. Well, so there's kind of that beautiful youth wonder where you're sort of, you know, like you have awe and it's not a surprise exactly, but it's a kind of immediate wonder, you know, and your eyes, I picture a child with their eyes flying open or...
Oh man, yes, a child's perspective, almost everything is a wonder.
Yeah,
huh? And if you're around them, it's such a joy for the person being there.
Yeah, you feel it too.
Yeah.
And if I see anyone experiencing it, I just feel all warmed up, no matter who they are. But the wonder I'm noticing differently is more reflective, more contemplative, slower, not less cool, but just profoundly different in like all wonder and wander for days about a single nanosecond event, like a dragonfly that died in my hand one day. I thought, you know, in that Virginia Woolf way, I thought about it for days, possibly a month. And that's a different kind of wonder, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Kind of a wonder and then reflecting back on it and doing a bit more with that moment of wonder than just, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Like a kid.
Yeah.
And of course, that's evident in the book. Now, Reading the Waves is called a memoir, including on the book's cover. But you also write in the preface, while this is not a memoir, it's a space of narrative transmogrify. Another word we see repeated throughout, very important in the book. And I love this last simile you used, like the body of a frog in a fairy tale.
Right?
Right.
I mean, that's what transmogrify is. They never listen to me. They always put the stamp of whatever on the cover, and so they put memoir on there. I still don't think it's a memoir. I still think it would be more accurate to call it catching a story in a certain trajectory of transmogrify. But you can't put that on the
No,
cover
you need a bigger cover, but, smaller print.
Yeah, but the other reason I don't think of it as a memoir is that though it dips into things that have happened in my life, for me, that's not the heart of the story. The heart of the story is more like in the I Ching or something. It's about change. And can we...
And transformation,
exactly,
transmogrify.
Exactly. So the memoir part is like, whatever, do what you have to do. But that's not what it is for me.
I think you said somewhere that they just put that on there because that way bookstores know where to shelve it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think of it as
capitalism. Like a favor to the bookstore owner.
Yeah, there's not like a special place
transmogrify,
for frogs or transmogrify.
Oh, man. I think I would hang out at that
totally.
Section. Yeah.
You would find me there.
Can you show me to the frog section?
I'd be there.
Now, the title Reading the Waves has multiple meanings. You write in the book, people are sometimes too interested in what happened. And this goes into a little what we talked about, the plod of plot and action. The drama is not the story, or the story of why how relationships dissolve or crescendo is every story living inside all of us to different degrees, rising and falling in waves. That's just one, I think, of the meanings there.
Yeah, I really... Well, you know this about me already, and most people do. I have such a kindredness with water and water creatures and how water moves and just all different ways. But back to that question of wonder, you know, I've studied some waves and I've studied some eddies in rivers and I've studied bath water and I've studied a glass of water, you know, slowly and patiently. And waves in particular, I remember, you know, really coming conscious of the idea that all of human life moves the way waves do. But sometimes we're okay thinking about that, and sometimes it's frightening. And
the wave kind of swallows us.
That's right.
It was funny because you described that you know waves. You swam in the ocean. When I was in high school in Los Angeles in Southern California, we used to go out in the summer to near the Santa Monica Pier.
Yeah.
And we would body surf.
Yeah.
And you learn very quickly when a wave swallows you up, takes you down below, you can't fight it.
No.
You wait it out and then it's gone and then you rise to the surface.
That's
right. I think that's something you've known for a long time.
Yeah. Same with, you know, like if you're caught in a cross current, fighting it isn't what's going to help
exactly,
you.
Exactly, yes. You're supposed to swim parallel to the shore.
That's right.
And then,
that's right.
You can't fight it. You can't fight the ocean.
That's right.
But you can be one with it or attempt to understand.
Yeah,
it.
And you could still not make it. I mean, that's a point
people
worth
drown,
making.
Yeah,
of course. My father drowned in the ocean in knee-high water. So it's not so much that you're sure to save your own life. It's more, can you remember that you're part of the motion of all existence with your body. And that's why I keep telling that story.
It also seems inherent in you, Lydia, your own love of water. From you mentioned the bathtub, which you said you used to hang out there as a kid.
Yeah.
To competitive swimming mm-hmm. as a teen, to recreational swimming now. And of course, for your enduring fondness for lakes, rivers, especially the ocean. It just seems something you were almost born with.
It does seem that way. I was talking to a brilliant writer friend of mine named Alex Baer, who maybe
yes.
you've met.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I haven't met her, but I know her.
Yeah.
Yeah, she lives in Portland.
And Alex just said to me last week, after knowing me for many years, she was like, "When you say you're a seal, you don't mean it metaphorically, do you?"
Oh, that's
and I
great.
Said, "No, I don't." We had like a breakthrough in our friendship. She's like, "I get it." Because I had recently had an encounter with a seal that I sat with on a shore for about an hour, and we were talking about seals. But that was just, I felt so seen for, you know, like a few minutes.
Yeah, there's a section in the book where you talk about getting a wetsuit so you could swim in the off the Oregon coast, which is very cold.
It's chilly.
Well, it's chilly. And you said how natural it felt and how great it felt because you felt like a seal.
Yeah. It gave me kid wonder, by the way. The first time I put it on, my eyes flew open. I went, I felt my second skin, you know, it was amazing. And I didn't even get in the water yet. This was just putting it on. It made me that happy. And then when I got in the water, I was just, I don't even know the language for what I felt. It just was incredible.
Maybe kind of an ecstasy almost.
Yeah,
huh?
An ecstatic state. I think that's it. Yeah, like that.
And one more meaning for the title, from the way you describe your writing process. And you said, "My writing practice moves the way ocean waves do, energy building underneath the surface, a surge upward, a crest, a massive roll, a dissipation. I wait for the waves. I've learned to trust that rhythm." And I love reading your prose so much. But so that's how you write now, too.
Yeah.
You mentioned in an interview, you know, a lot of the advice is, write for at least an hour or two every day. You don't do that.
I can't. And for many years, I think in my 30s and probably my 40s, too, I was carrying that barnacle that grows on you where, like, I must be doing it wrong because I'm not doing it the way all these other very amazing people say to do it. But somewhere in my 40s and into my 50s, I was like, fuck that. I do it this other way, and it's okay to embrace that. It's okay to glory in that, or, you know, thrive inside this other way. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, the proof is in your work. You know, you don't have to prove yourself any more than that.
Not really. Now that I'm this age, I'm like, I don't really care what anyone thinks anymore about it. So if it's beautiful for me, maybe it can help a few other people too. And I do care about that.
And maybe more writers do that than they'll let on.
It could be.
Unless you're somebody like a Stephen King who probably writes a certain amount every day. And, he puts out 2-3 books a year. So.
Not it.
Yeah.
I also, just to squeeze another meaning in there about reading the waves. And you saw this. Virginia Woolf's book, The Waves, was a real touchstone for me when I was first becoming a writer, and remained a touchstone that I returned to and literally touched over and over again. It still is. My first copy looks like a dog ate it, pooped it out, re-ate it, spit it in the water. You know, it just looks really well read and loved. And her writing, you know, she's famous for writing in what was called stream of consciousness.
Yes.
And so that's partly why I put a thread or a stream of her into the storytelling as a kind of homage to this.
And an epigraph.
Yeah.
And also to The Lighthouse, I think you cite in the book.
Too. Pretty much everything she's ever written.
And of course, she was one of the people who died drowning.
Yeah.
But possibly purposely, I think.
I think so, too.
Uh-huh. Now, in the middle of the book, you mention a Lithuanian, and that's your heritage, term Nugribauti. Mm-hmm. I had to look that up, but I practiced. I think it's close, which means to lose one's way, to become distracted, to lose the thread of a story or sense, to get lost wandering, mm-hmm. not wondering. And it also seems to describe your writing style. You lose a thread or follow it down a different path, but it amazes me how you almost always come back from your wandering. And not necessarily tying them all together, but not forgetting what came before.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an... I've had this intuitively my whole writing life, which is resist conclusions, resist a thesis, resist knowing. Like I was born. I probably came out of the chute like, nope, no conclusion. but the more I've studied, the concept and looked at many literary and artistic examples, this notion that I want to be in the group of people who let storytelling take different shapes and forms. And I want to be the person who can follow those forms and see what they bloom into, whether I'm going to conclude or know something or not. It's beautiful to let expression play out on the page. And as you see, you don't end up nowhere and you don't end up in nonsense land.
Oh, no.
You end up having felt the journey more than the... Well, now I sound like a kind of West Coast cliche. I was going to say more than the destination. But, you know, it's more in process and letting the process have the meaning.
And let the reader take it from there.
Yeah.
You're giving them all the tools or the information. You know, I taught a place where you taught before you as a teaching assistant at San Diego State. Mm-hmm. We had to teach composition, like beginning composition. And one of the tips was, of course, the typical essay.
Of course.
In college, a thesis statement, and then you support it, and then you conclude.
I had to teach it, too. I just didn't.
Yeah, so it was such a revelation when a teacher or two told me about the French essayists, and they don't do that at all.
No.
They start off, and they wander.
Yeah, because the word essay means to try.
Right.
I mean, it's just a profoundly different concept.
And beautiful essays, too. And almost like you're reading something that's literature and not a formula.
Yeah, because they're more, words that kind of work over here are meditation or reflection. They're more that kind of intellectual and emotional journeying than the five-paragraph thesis conclusion essay, which is so American and so capitalist to me. I mean, I'm bringing that and bludgeoning with it. That's what I think about it. But even when that was my assignment as a teacher, I never taught that. I just snuck in different ways.
Oh, good for you. I think that's good for the students.
Some of them, anyway.
Now, you have four epigraphs to Reading the Ways. One's by Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
And one comes from one of your other favorite writers, Jeanette Winterson. If you continually write and read yourself as fiction, you can change what's crushing you. You also quote her as saying, you forge selves through fiction. And for you, perhaps through memoir as well, where in a way you're writing yourself as fiction as a character in the work.
Yeah. I don't think... I make as hard a line between fiction and nonfiction as, say, some other writers you've probably talked to. I think that forms swim in and out of each other. And storytelling is not just reporting what happened to you. Storytelling is an artistic expression with transmutations and transformations and curations and composition, and is how much light, how much sound, who did you focus on? So once you're in storytelling space, you're not in the land of here are the facts of what happened. And if you're liberated from here are the facts of what happened, you can talk about why it mattered and let that be the story. And in that story space, change is possible.
And in fact, even in your fiction, you have some autobiographical details. I know the...
Almost always.
Yeah, the girl in Small Backs of Children, she loses a child at birth, stillborn. Lasvi in Thrust, she has this affinity to water And as we find out in this book, too, you had pennies, which I guess your dad collected them.
He collected them and I ate some of them. That's right. Don't eat pennies, kids. It's bad.
Right. And the copper is worth a lot more these days. You know, just
I have said this out loud before. I jumped off a ferry in Seattle when I was a kid and everybody was scared.
I didn't know that. Have you written about that? Or?
Yeah, it's in some kind of experimental essay that I've forgotten the name of.
Okay, not the two memoirs, though.
No.
Memoirs, quotes.
No, it's in fiction exclusively.
Wow. Now, one of the events that was crushing you was the stillbirth of your daughter, Lily, in 1983.
Yes.
We've talked about this before and how it left a hole in you. And in one of our previous conversations, you said that Lily's death is, quote, probably the origin point for all my writings, which means her death was generative of everything. Now, in Thrust, one of the characters, Aurora, writes in a letter, I bring to the surface of the body and the psyche stories held so deeply within us that we shudder to speak them. I bring stories to life so that we might recover our own bodies. Is that right? Writing does seem to be kind of like that for you, a way to recover your own body. And the body is so important to you. And in your work, you even have the writing workshop, Corporeal.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
Yes.
Yeah, Aurora, I put a lot of what happens with my own intellect and its hamster wheel, unstoppable hamster wheel, into characters like Aurora or Christine in Book of Joan. Like, it's so fun to just let them mouth off about things I can't shut up in my own brain, and there's no one to talk to because they'd get bored within 8 minutes, I'm sure. But characters, you know, you can let them go on and have rants or manifestos.
Or write these long letters.
Yeah,
like
long
Aurora
letters.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's very close to what you said, but I've been thinking about it lately, and maybe partly writing for me is how to keep my body in the world and be embodied and stay in the world and, you know, not put rocks in my pockets and walk into a river.
Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when we had our short story roundtable, one question I asked to all the writers there to get the most, got the most enthusiastic response, what's it like being both writer and mother? And we've talked about the influence of your daughter Lily had on your writing. Now, your son Miles, I think, recently graduated college. And from the University of Oregon, mm-hmm. where, by the way, you got your graduate degree, met your second husband, Devin, and you were a student of Ken Kesey.
Yes.
So maybe this question is kind of like describing the ocean or something, but what's been Miles' influence?
It's like
writing.
Describing the ocean.
Exactly,
I could just speak of my relationship with him as his mother and, you know, just how generative that oceanic or galactic space of love and wonder is. But I've been talking to him recently because we both live back in Portland now, and I have a different kind of awe around him, which is that he's an autonomous being who's a young man, and being around him doesn't any longer feel like, you know, he's my baby, he came out, you know, it's not that. It's like I have this incredible chance to witness this person in their becoming, and I don't want to miss anything. And he is just fucking beautiful. And I mean, his innerness. He's also fairly good looking, but that's not what I meant.
I've seen pictures.
He's got amazing hair. But, you know, I have so much. It's almost like another kind of ecstatic state to bear witness to someone else's becoming. I just think it's astonishing. And I feel humbled and lucky and, you know, like, oh my God, I get to be near that. But he is autonomous. And this is not an easy thing for mothers, you know. Although we both read a lot and make art about that whole chimera idea that we share that his brain materials and me and my brain materials and him and the blood-brain barrier and the like we're both nerdy about that in a cool way. So anyway, you know what I mean? It's his other person.
Exactly. Yeah. Seen him as growing up. Yeah, you know, he's not there yet, but he's an adult.
Yeah.
Autonomous, as you say. Now, you write in The Small Backs of Children that this is a mother-daughter story, and that's true with Reading the Waves as well. With you as both mother and daughter, we've talked about you as mother of Lily and Miles, but you also write about yourself as daughter growing up with your mother, Dorothy, who you love dearly, but she suffered from depression and alcoholism. There was one incident, you know, I haven't heard you talk about before, and it was in Reading the Waves. It happened when you were a teen, Lydia, living at home. You had your first intimate experience with another girl. She was a friend on the swim team.
Yeah.
Your mother found out and stopped you from seeing her. And in the book you write, my mother's early erasure of my erotic experience with a girl hides underneath every story. Can you talk about that? And I also, I wonder if you have ever thought how things would be different if she didn't walk in on you, she was more tolerant.
Yeah, I know. They would have been very different because it was a moment of my own queerness, like, blooming.
It was who you were.
Yeah, from the inside, right. Not some any other kind of influence.
How people tell you to be.
Yeah. And so I happened to know. And plus, I was a girl on a swim team where same-sex, you know, interaction was not uncommon. I mean, so I had kind of the right petri dish, is what I'm saying. Uh-huh. And I had it emerging from me in a kind of, I don't like that word pure, but, you know, organic form. And that my mother was the one to, you know, put the brakes on it, did something weird to me because I hadn't finished figuring out how to love my mother at that age. We hadn't worked that out at all. And so I think some kind of schism happened where I thought I had to choose my mother. I'm not saying I knew this at that time, but when I look back at it, like my devotion, I didn't want her to feel as if I'd left her or something. But I think a lot of things would have been different. I think it's important to note that I have been intimate with women my entire adult life, here and there in the like cracks and fissures between husbands, which sounds hilarious, but that's kind of how it played out. But not with that early, you know, freedom. Mm-hmm. And
so that's kind of always there for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it was. Kinda. It's less and less.
Oh, good.
But yeah, I can point to it and notice that that was a wounding for sure. And I didn't know what to do about it or how to live it.
It's a prejudice on her part that had nothing to do with you, really.
Yeah, yeah. And it came from an unexpected place. I was used to, you know, the father criticism and abuse and horribleness. It came from a place I wasn't expecting it.
Your mom.
Yeah.
Well, you also write about your father in the book. He was abusive emotionally and physically. I think as early as you were 5 years old, you say, and your sister Bridget. But in 1985, you mentioned he drowned, but actually he was drowning. And you saved him, which marked a turning point in your relationship. And I think in him, too.
probably, yeah.
Because he lost his memory.
Yeah.
Wow. And he was just a different person.
Yeah. He lost the part of him that was abusive and angry and rageful and terrible, narcissistic. Like that fell off in the water with his memory. So
that seems to be quite a positive.
I mean, it is a positive, but
he went through all that before he was,
yeah, and to have so. The person, you know, that fell off of him meant it was in our bodies, and what are we supposed to do with it?
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that doesn't go away.
No. So you have choices. You can repress it. You can work through it. You can get help. You can act out. You can, but it doesn't just disappear just because it dissolved in him.
And it's still there as kind of almost, an influence. I don't know if that's the right word, but some undercurrent.
Less and less, because I have made the choice to work through it with, you know, like therapy and art.
Yes, you're writing and now painting.
Yeah, and a lot of somatic work too, which I know people on the West Coast anyway know what that means.
Well, that must be very important to you because you believe these memories are in our body.
Yeah, so.
They become us, part of us.
So in as much as a person can release stuff like that, I've released a large oceans of it.
Now, another important relationship in the book, which I enjoyed reading about, I liked reading about it in the book, was with your second husband, Devin. And you met Devin in grad school, as we said, the U of O in Eugene, fell in love. You were married for about 11 years. He died tragically a few years after the marriage ended, either falling or jumping from a construction crane that he climbed while he was drunk. And you describe this in a very powerful chapter in the book, Skydiver.
Yeah.
Actually, there's three skydivers,
which
are all about Devin. Can you talk about how you found out about Devin's death? The autopsy report you read years later, which you actually have a picture of in the book.
Yeah.
And what you say in the book is your attempt to write him back to life, quote, even if it kills me, an impossible story. Man, how often do we wish we could do that with people that are gone?
Yeah. I mean, you can't. But you can remember, and you can also, I mean, the best I can do for my daughter or Devin or my mother is open story space up and let some beauty of them breathe.
There's a lot of beauty of Devin in there.
Oh,
I mean,
you don't
really cover up the warts.
I covered a lot of
them. Oh, covered a lot. Well, at one point, he points a gun in your chest, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of a big wart.
That was a big wart. And, you know, the kind of terrible things that happen when things go not great in a relationship. But again, the impulse of my heart and soul was to just open story space up and let some things that were beautiful about this man breathe. And if I could put all his paintings in there, I would, but there wasn't that no one would give me permission for that. But I would have.
You also mentioned something that you call the Book of Devin. It was a sketchbook of writings and drawings that he sent you from Paris.
He did.
Because he figured you were the one who would get it.
He mailed it to me. And it was both beautiful and terrible because he had taken up with a young woman who was a drug addict herself, but beautiful and young. And he was telling me about how she was like me at 23. And so I was, you know, on the floor sobbing, trying to process that. And he mails me this book. And at that time, I was unable, you know, it just annihilated me. But all these years later, it's an artifact of more than that pain I experienced. And so I can, like we talked about, as an older woman, I can see it and feel it and process it as an artifact of, it's beautiful. It's a piece, a little sediment of him. It's a fragment of him.
It's almost like the pain becomes something that not just you felt, but you understand now where it's coming from.
Yeah.
You get to understand, even though you spent so much time with him, you get to understand Devin a little better from something he probably never revealed to you, some of these writings.
Yeah, I would say that. And then the reason I have the autopsy report is that when I got the news that Devin had died from a friend on Facebook who was trying to tell me lovingly, it's just Facebook is so stupid.
Oh, what a bad place to get notified.
You know,
huh?
Just dumb. But there's nothing wrong with the woman's impulse who tried to tell me, hey. But the more remarkable thing was that my third husband, Andy, understood what a big deal it was to me. And he knew without my saying that I would want to know how it had happened. And so he hired a private detective of some sort to go get the information so that the day I was ready to learn it, it would be there.
I want to talk a little bit about Andy, third husband and the father of Miles, too.
Mm-hmm.
Both of your son. You were married for many years, over 20. And he seems to be nicer and kinder guy than Philip, I think, your first husband, and Devin, the second husband. Before Andy, you write that most of my relationships with men were at the nexus of desire and violence. And you talk in very positive terms about Andy in both Chronology and Reading the Waves. Did you want to talk more about him now and kind of?
Sure. Well, like legions of other people, our relationship is changing forms. And it just so happens that it's changing forms right when this book came out, which I was not expecting.
Right, early in the year, because I know you canceled your book tour.
Yeah, I wasn't able to function at all, and I went into a very traumatic space. But I can say that it was nearly 25 years that we were together.
Wow, that's a very long marriage.
It's a long marriage, and in that space of knowing each other and being with each other and parenting together, we made amazing art together. We opened up kinds of love that neither one of us knew about before that. We probably healed some of our family trauma stuff by, you know,
abusive parents, abusive father too.
Yeah. Right? He didn't have an abusive father. His father died when he was three.
Oh, okay. So that sense of loss.
But
there.
He had some pretty heavy neglect from his mother that, and I had an abusive father, so we were quite a pair.
Right. One of each.
Oops, sorry. And so I think some healing, some challenges, some art, some love, you know, multiple kinds of love. But, you know, when you're in a relationship, early on, you can tell me if you agree with this. It's always been true for me. You see some early fractures and fault lines, and you catch yourself thinking, I wonder what shape those will take later in life.
But you kind of gloss over it.
You
don't
kind
you
of gloss over them because
well,
you're
maybe they'll
in love
go away.
And
yeah.
This, you know, I'm probably imagining things uh-huh. and this is great. And Nobody's perfect. All the things you say. And then if you're in a long-term relationship, you're going to hit periods where the fractures and fault lines rear up and you're like, oh, this is it. Yep, here it is. And then either you make it through that together or you don't.
And you made it through a lot.
We made it through a lot
of them.
We made it through a lot of them. And so this might be the one. And it's looking like it is. But, you know, to have known someone. I was talking to Elizabeth Woody, the poet.
Oh, I don't know her.
Native American poet here in Oregon. She was the poet laureate. Many years ago. Uh-huh. She's a native elder now. Amazing woman. I was lamenting and oversharing a little bit on this topic, and she said to me that she's only been with her current partner a short while, a small number of years. And she said, but aren't we all lucky to exchange DNA and energy of any sort with each other before we leave? And I thought, she said the right thing.
What a nice way of looking at it.
At the right time. And so
you're fortunate just to meet him and be together with him all those years.
Yeah. So I'm not done feeling what I'm feeling. Trust me, I'm still on my healing journey, or whatever we're calling it. But that was a profoundly true moment for me to feel what she said about that. It is worth it to know each other no matter what happens.
And you have Miles.
Then there's Miles. And Miles is everything.
Of you and Andy. And he was also an artist. He filmmaker, screenwriter.
Yes.
And you said he's quite a cello player now.
He's a beautiful cello player. I don't know what forms and shapes his life's about to take. I just know that the form and shape we had going on together isn't what's happening now. So,
from the husbands, I want to get to another relative. And this again has to do with grief. It's such an important theme running through the new book and your other work. In fact, you write, I have spent whole decades inside grief. Now, a very early story, this was something Kimberly King Parsons told me about, this Amy Hempel story in the cemetery where Al Jolson is buried.
Love that story.
What a powerful story, yeah. It ends with a line, "Fluent now in the language of grief," which she actually has a tattoo of that. And you had that fluency from an early age. There's a section of the book about your cousin, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were an early teen then, maybe 12 or so, in Texas, who was brutally beaten before she was stuffed inside the trunk of a burning car and they never found the killer. And you write, "When I heard that, I couldn't breathe. I went a little deaf. My arms both went numb." But at that time, you really had no outlet for that grief.
No.
That's an incident I just hadn't heard about and hadn't read about, but how horrible.
I've tried to write about that over the course of my adult life, and I've always not been able to or pulled back or something. And the only reason...
It was just too sad or...
It's not so much that, because as you know, I have some sad stuff already. So it's not like that was more sad or too much sad or something. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much that. It was more like I wanted to find the place to stand in order to share the story that wasn't standing on her grave or standing on her body or taking a story.
Yes.
And so weaving it into my family story of love and grief and death was a place I could stand to share that story.
Again, you're in the memoir, you're not just describing what's happening.
That's right.
You're telling the story and transforming it, and it took you a while to find that story.
Right.
And in reading the waves, you did in that one chapter.
And by sharing that story, I could open the story space up of the difficulty of loving my mother, learning to love my mother, who came from these Texan women who had terrible stories in their bodies and lives. And so that, you know, here are these women who I am related to, that I have, you know, a lineage with these women, and their lives carried violence from men in it. And so, see, the story opened up, and I wasn't just like, let me tell you about this cousin Michelle, and
oh, right.
I'm going to tell you all about it.
It also allows you to reflect on Texas, which doesn't have
the
best
my favorite
memories for you. I think you were gang raped in college there at Lubbock,
yep.
Texas
freshman Tech. Year.
Yeah, and you broke up with Devin, I think, in Austin,
yep.
Texas. And then there's one section where you're on the plane, you're going to go speak in Houston, and you just can't go through with it. You call Andy from the airport and say, please pick me up. I can't.
Yeah,
go.
My body did that.
Mm-hmm.
My brain was like...
Yeah, but you listened to it.
I did.
A lot of people don't. They would have gotten on the plane.
That's right. That was a big...
Maybe had a drink or something.
That's right. Which I had done in the past, maybe not go to Texas, but I had repressed and went numb and masked. And that day was probably a turning point for me of saying yes to my body and no to the... coping strategies.
Just listening more to your body and not to what everybody's expecting of you.
Exactly. Huh.
Now, one of the things that struck me as I read the book, Lydia, was how many close calls you had, including a few near-death experiences, I think almost drowning in a kayak. I had the same thought I did while I was reading Keith Richards, The Rolling Stones. He had a memoir, Life. And I'm wondering, how are they still alive?
Especially Keith.
Oh, yeah. He fell out of trees. He was all kinds of car crashes. He was chased by people in Jamaica, you know, with knives. And but you have that incredible, I don't know, life spirit. There's something in you.
I wonder myself. I think I've come to a couple of ideas about that. One is I do have a little fire in me that is stubborn, is what I would say. But then there's this other thing. I think luck isn't the right word. I think some people are able to like collapse into this slipstream of experience when intense things are happening differently than other people. Other people would break a bone or die or drown. But some of us just kind of like fall into the, you really are part of everything around you. This table isn't solid. It's moving molecules. Huh. And I don't mean we consciously, like me and Keith don't consciously think.
Oh, right.
Now I think I have a new buddy, me and Keith.
Keith Richards,
kidding.
Yeah. He's a good buddy to have.
Totally kidding. But you know what I mean? Like, I think some of us react to intensity with a kind of surrender, not like give up surrender, but I am part of everything. Maybe a little more like Buddhist surrender.
There's a lot of what I felt was kind of Buddhist thought in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
About life is suffering, but that's how you learn compassion.
Yeah, yeah. But not in a kind of American sense where it's an equation.
Right.
Right? Uh-huh. But in a constant motion, like water sense. But anyway, that's a couple of theories I have about why I'm not dead yet.
Well, I'm so glad you're not. I think many people are.
Thank you.
Now, you've been painting recently, and you posted some amazing examples of your artwork on social media. And it's something I don't think you've done for like 40 years, you said. You were at a boarding house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The woman who owned it was named Olga. And when you left, she gave you a parting gift of paints and a canvas, which you never used. And it was almost like repression of that urge. And now you're painting. And those works in particular, they're a flow, a wave-like aspect to the paintings. So instead of reading the waves, it's almost like you're painting them now.
Oh, that's so cool to hear. That's cool to hear. I'm definitely in the motion of something. You know, like that's what it feels like.
And spirals too, some of the things you were saying about.
Lots of them.
Yeah.
Circles and
yeah, the color, it's like waves.
It's a lot like that. That's really cool to hear that. I mean from my point of view, it feels like people are being really nice to me.
Oh no, it's something like, different and beautiful.
That's really it's good to receive it and make emotion even between you and I about it, because I'm doing them. You know, just from my own alone point of view, I'm doing them to stay alive. It's what's helping me remain on the planet. And my go-to, which is writing, is far away from me right now. I know it's not gone.
Oh, it will come back.
Yeah.
Like waves.
Yeah, like waves. But the expressive form that's coming out of me are these paintings, which I think of as studies for what I really want to do, which is like 6 foot by 6 foot versions.
Oh, wow. That's.
But I live right now in a really, as we were speaking earlier, a dumb apartment next to some railroad tracks. So there's no place for me to be doing.
You need a studio with a high ceiling.
I do. I need it. It would be wonderful. But in my head, there's studies for, you know, what could become something some other time in my life.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, because I really love the work that I've seen
so far.
Thank you.
That's nice to hear. Thank you.
Now, in addition to the painting, two more artistic projects I'd like to talk about. One's not all yours. That's the film adaptation of the first memoir, The Chronology of Water, mm-hmm. Directed by Kristen Stewart, with a screenplay by Kristen and your husband, Andy. You were listed on the credits as a story consultant. I was wondering what your role was. And I don't think you've seen it yet, even though it debuted at premiered at Cannes.
Alas, a few months ago. I have yet to see it. I have not seen it. I've read a lot about it, and I'm starting to get the gist because I got a pretty good imagination. So,
you're the story consultant.
I haven't seen it. I think my role was very early on in Kristen's creative process, where she would check in. Early on in the process, Kristen was kind of vibing off me or riffing off me, and she was in her own creative process, but she would give me questions about certain scenes or people, and so we would back and forth like that. And the further she got into the process, the less she and I were in touch.
The more her voice came into it.
Yeah.
The reviews say it's fantastic, and she tells the narrative in a way that I think you would love, certainly not the typical movie chronology,
right?
You know, act 1, 2, and 3.
Right. I mean, from what I could tell from reading about it, I'd love to see it someday. it sounds kind of like an intense collage poem that, you know, is not allegiant to the plot we were talking about earlier, but to the emotional intensities that, you know, flash up in memory. And if she achieved that, then I'm just so thrilled for her. It's her piece of art, and
right.
I can't wait to witness it.
And one more creative project, yeah. Lydia. You have so many. You actually have an anthology you edited coming out early next year called The Big M, 13 Writers Take Back the Story of Menopause, The
yeah.
Big M, which fits right in with some of your themes like the body and transformation,
yeah,
transmogrifying. Can you give us a preview? What gave you the idea of probably you going through menopause and your friends?
Absolutely. You know, my peer group and me, and we are all dismayed and frustrated that the information we're given and the stories that get passed down are so heavy and limiting and narrow. And I knew for a fact that neither my personal experience nor the experiences of my friends were that narrow. Like, our stories are expansive as ocean or space, to go back to
which
that
which is good, because as a man, all I know is hot flashes.
I know, right? And that's just absurd.
Right.
So it's kind of opening story space up to, okay, what else? Because this is a profoundly, talk about a transmogrify.
And not just a physical one.
Exactly. It's probably when women are at their strongest and most beautiful and kind of a zenith of what we have to give, you know, like the grandmother whales in a pod. And yet the story of us is we should recede and be shut away. So you didn't think I was going to recede and be shut away.
Oh, not ready, no.
So we're becoming, you know, the grandmother whales in the pod.
And you've got some really good writers in there.
They're amazing.
Cheryl Strait, Monica Drake. Both Portland-based, but several other really well-known voices in there.
Absolutely, and hopefully some new voices too, from very different ages of woman, including a trans woman. And, you know, so it was important to say it's not just age 55. It's like intergenerational, it's interdisciplinary, it's different women from all over the world. And again, we're trying to open up story space to what else? And what do we have to give that can be useful for the people coming right behind us?
One more question or comment here. We mentioned Cheryl Strait. So for her Substack, you gave an interview on Reading the Ways much earlier in the year. She asked if you had any advice. You said, when afraid, become a new story, become a new creature, conjure another kind of a repetitive word in Reading the Ways,
yeah.
Word that you repeat, conjure the new myths, new shapes, new voices, and bodies. Well, as you know, it's a very difficult time now in our country, actually kind of a very a frightening time. And people are afraid, they're concerned, some are angry. Yeah, I'm very angry.
Yeah.
Does that advice still apply? It must, huh?
I think we're being called to radically change forms, whether we want to or not. And we can experience that as trauma and seclusion and sitting with your own rage, or we can experience it as the opportunity to lend each other a hand in the transmogrifies and do it together and lock arms and voices and take turns, like, I'm going to shovel the shit one day and you can shovel it the next and bandage the wound or put my body between an ice agent and something else. Like, we'll take turns. I think the great call is, are we going to do it together or are we going to isolate into our own, you know, anuses with how terrible it is? Something terrible has always been happening in every part of the world. The entire time the world has existed with humans on it. And so it's the call to turn your head and see who's next to you and see what we can do together and take turns.
You know, Rebecca Solnit actually wrote a book about that, about catastrophes and tragedies.
Mm-hmm.
And the one silver lining, the positive, was people coming together in a community.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, like these great pulses of small cells of people who endure and refuse to give up, even if it's not for me or for you, it's worth it for whoever's coming, that somebody turn to somebody else and say, no, we're not giving up, even if it's not going to benefit me personally.
Well, Lydia, you've said that personally you're in a deep dive now, and we talked a little bit about it. But fortunately, you know about diving.
I do.
And while you're down there, before you surface, you hope to bring back something useful for others. You've said that. You've done that so many times in the past, including the new book, and I know you will again. I want to thank you so much for talking with us, for coming in here and talking with me. Just a joy.
And the pleasure is so mine. And every time I talk to you, I just feel better. You radiate a kind of warmth and generosity of spirit and soul and listening. And you're just a kick in the pants to talk to. So thank you for having me.
Oh, man. Thank you very much. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Lydia Yuknovich, author of the new memoir, Reading the Ways, from Riverhead Books. The anthology, The Big M, 13 Writers Take Back the Story of Menopause, edited by Lydia, comes out in January from Grand Central Publishing. You can find out more about Lydia, her work, her classes, and all her upcoming events online at lydiayuknovich.net. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, August 14th. We'll be talking God and Sex, the new novel from John Raymond, another great Portland-based writer. I tell you, there must be something in the water here. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
your failures and fears are portals. Step through.